Welcome to another bonus episode of What a Hell of a Way to Die. If you're hearing this, you're likely a premium subscriber, and I want to take a minute to say thanks. Your support helps us make this show a reality. So, it's rare that I get to meet people I would consider heroes, much less actually interview them on my own show. This episode, however, is an exception. Matthew Ho is a combat veteran of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, who now devotes his life to combating the effects of militarism and imperialism. It would be hard for me to encapsulate in words the level of respect that I feel for him. This episode is the entirety of our recorded conversation. I hope you enjoy, and thanks so much again for your support. All right. Matt, thanks for being on our show, and just wanted to start out, if you could just introduce yourself to the audience, and if you want to talk about your time in the Marine Corps as well as in the State Department, that'd be really helpful.
Yeah, sure. Name is Matthew Ho. I live in Wake Forest, North Carolina. I went into the Marine Corps in 1998, January of 1998, through Officer Candidate School. I had worked for a couple years after college, and I was bored. Wanted something bigger, you know, wanted something satisfying in life. Didn't want to have my existence measured by being someone who was doing finance, which is what I was doing. So basically putting numbers into spreadsheets, more or less. I wanted something bigger and more fulfilling. So I ended up joining. Actually, you know, I mean, I like to tell people, originally I was looking to get into the fire department, but at that point in the 90s, in like 96, 97, the big city fire departments weren't hiring, or you had to wait 2 years for the test, or I had just missed a test. So yeah, I ended up going into the Marine Corps. And I was a combat engineer officer a few years in Okinawa, and then force gumped myself into a really senior position as a junior person at the Pentagon. I had a battalion XO, and he hated me, and I hated him, and I was a company XO. And every day I wake up knowing I was going to get to a fight with this guy. And one day he calls me and says, "Hey, do you want to go to work in Washington D.C.?" And at that point, I knew from talking to my monitor, which is in the Marine Corps, the monitors are the career advisors. I forget what they call them in the Army. And
it would be it's at branch headquarters. You basically have your branch representative. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, it's similar. Yeah. There's a person of a relatively similar officer grade who's your point of contact.
Yeah, and so this guy, I remember being told very clearly that I remember him saying to me, "You've got two choices: officer selection office Buffalo or recruiting station Detroit. But I'll give you the choice." You know, like, what a great guy, terrific. Detroit or Buffalo, you know, as recruiting, fantastic. You know, so yeah, my battalion XO calls and says, "Hey, do you want to go work in Washington D.C.?" And I said, "Absolutely, of course." And I ended up getting this job as a White House liaison officer for the Secretary of Navy, where I ended up doing a lot of correspondence, did a lot of protocol. I was basically the junior Marine Corps officer on the secretary's personal staff. I just ended up being in this like mini think tank, basically, for the Secretary of the Navy, and saw a lot of things and had a lot of experiences that most junior captains can't imagine, right? I mean, so it really was. And through only because my battalion XO and I hated each other, and he wanted me out of there, type of deal. And this was a hot fill. It came up as they need somebody in DC. So this is a good way to get, you know, Ho out of here. So, I got there in 2002, in late 2002. I was there through the beginning of the Iraq War. And I had a very interesting job, or one of my duties was as the White House liaison officer for the Marine Corps. I think that a lot of your listeners will find interesting is I was responsible for dealing with the White House in terms of Marine Corps casualties for the Iraq and Afghan wars. And the second kid we had killed in Iraq, his record of emergency data, was wrong. The address was wrong. So the letter from President Bush that went to his family got returned. And the White House, of course, flipped out. And I remember my boss, who was the EA to the Secretary of Navy, saying to me, hey, Captain Ho, from now on, you will call every casualty officer and verify personally the address for each of these Marines. And I said, okay. And so what ended up happening was I start calling these casualty officers, or CACOs, as we called them in the Marine Corps. And these were the men and women, the officers who were dealing directly with the families of the Marines who were being killed in Iraq. And it just became, so the war became very personal to me very quickly, because there are a lot of things that are being screwed up on the Marine Corps side in terms of the casualty process. I mean, we could do a whole show on that, but it became a very personal thing because I ended up getting in direct contact with the families very often. And so right away, the war was very personal to me. But also too, being at that level and seeing what was occurring on a macro side with the wars, and seeing how the Marine Corps handled things, and how, you know, colonels and generals were already at that point more interested in making sure the bureaucratic functions of the Marine Corps were going forward, making sure the narrative of the Marine Corps was going forward, and making sure their own careers were going to go forward. This whole casualty thing eventually blew up with me writing a brief for the Commandant of the Marine Corps about how the Marine Corps casualty process was broken. My understanding that the Commandant threw this piece of paper at Lieutenant General Parks, who was the head of manpower for Marine Corps. And I was really assaulted from a variety of Marine Corps officers at Headquarters Marine Corps personally, and my career was threatened and everything else because I had done that, because they weren't being responsive to the casualty process. I mean, the casualty process was just strictly broken. We were sending bills from Dover and from Walter Reed and Bethesda to the families of the dead and wounded Marines. We were mailing Purple Hearts to people. We were just, I mean, like, and that's just the beginning of it, but like, we were refusing to intern various people at Arlington Cemetery after their families had been told so. Like, the whole process was broken. And so very quickly saw this. I had this experience that was very heartbreaking, yeah, but also was that classic war experience that I think so many guys and gals have, of you go into it and you think that for some reason your generation is going to be different than all the previous generations, and things like this are going to be handled in a certain way, or the people who are people come around, or people become heroes all of a sudden in whatever position they're in because they're doing the right thing because of the ethos of the Marine Corps. And right away, it wasn't there. And something so basic as taking care of the families of Marines who were killed was just pushed aside for bureaucratic and personal reasons of, you know, basically not getting in trouble or trying to suppress the bad news. So, yes, I mean, I ended up after that. Getting out of the Marine Corps, getting off of active duty. At that point, I had about six and a half years in. And I think, like a lot of guys too, we had those of us who were on we called the Marine Corps B billets or shore tours, thought we had missed the war. We thought we had missed it. You know, I mean, summer of 2003, the Marine Corps is leaving Iraq. And the general consensus, the general wisdom is that, yeah, things aren't great there, but eventually it'll calm down. Eventually we'll get some people into power and things will get straightened out, and there'll be a law and order situation that will be difficult, but not. Yeah. So I ended up coming off of active duty. Again, like a lot of my friends, like a lot of these junior captains who were my peers, my friends, we felt like we had missed it. I mean, little did we know what was going to happen and understand how long and what it would be like and how often we would get to go. But I ended up actually, a friend of mine had gotten a guy, Navy officer I was working with, had been assigned to the Coalition Provisional Authority which was the Department of Defense's organization for running Iraq, for the, basically the colonial administration.
Can I just pause so the reader or listeners understand? You may have heard of Paul Bremer, who was the head of the CPA, but what Matt just said, yeah, the colonial administration, I just want to emphasize that. We've talked a little bit about that first year in Iraq that kind of set the tone for things being screwed up. So I just, my ears pricked up. I wanted to make sure everybody else's did too.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I mean, I remember it being in February. So when I was in the Pentagon, they were redoing the Pentagon. They were renovating the Pentagon, which was, and so my buddy and I used to go get coffee out of our office, and we would cut through the renovated section. And this is, this is February of 2003, and one of the abandoned offices was all of a sudden had literally, they had like a handwritten sign, like on a torn off piece of loose leaf paper, you know, it seemed like, I mean, a little nicer than that, but not much more. And what it said was Office of Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, which was ORHA, which a guy named Jay Garner was in charge, and a former general. And this was the predecessor to the Coalition Provisional Authority. This lasted only about a month or so before Garner and his staff were removed and Bremer was put in April or May of 03 or early May of 03. But literally, I mean, this was the Department of Defense did not establish an actual office, did not establish a location for staff to work for what we were calling, you know, at that point, phase four of combat operations, which was, you know, the reconstruction, the development, the post-combat part of Iraq. That wasn't even set up and stood up until February of 03. That just shows you just how little everything you've heard about there is no planning. Absolutely, there was no planning. I mean, they didn't even give these people the space to do planning in, let alone assign people. Because then I ran into a friend of mine a couple weeks later who was up in the Pentagon. I said, "What are you doing up here?" Because I knew he was at Quantico at Weapons Training Battalion. And he said, "Yeah, I've just been reassigned to this thing called ORHA. We're supposed to be figuring out what to do with Iraq after we, you know, after we put our troops in there." I mean, and this was literally at this point, 2-3 weeks before the invasion. So it kind of really showed where the mindset was, where the priority was, and how any type of thinking that was not just negative or things might not go well there, but was even just responsible or anything more complicated than just, two reinforced divisions up the middle was outside of the box of thinking for a lot of the Pentagon.
Well, I mean, I helped plan medical assistance packages in Central America in 2010, 2011, and I remember doing a quick respond to flooding in Panama and sending 2 Chinook helicopters and like 20 doctors and a couple of airmen and some security forces took like a week of staff planning. So one imagines that trying to put together the staff plans for an entire country's worth of humanitarian assistance is probably going to take longer than a few weeks. And that's kind of mind-boggling to think that that wasn't part of the plan when, you know, the actual tactical component was thought out in the middle of 02. Like as far as I understand, that the planning had been going on for a while. That's the one thing where the staff work that had been done before was actually factored into the decision, was how to, you know, get from across the border Kuwait, you know, to Baghdad or from, you know, the Turkish border in the north down south. So that is kind of mind-boggling. But something I was also interested in, Matt, you went back to Iraq as a, you know, as you said, were as a National Guard or a reserve component officer.
Yeah, Marine officer, Marine Reserve officer. So I, when I got out, I was, you know, I just transitioned to the IIR. I looked at joining a local reserve unit. But I actually, as I was saying, a buddy of mine who got detailed down to CPA in their human resources office, and, you know, Ken could verify, and he was a Navy officer, he's a surface warfare officer, but they put him in human resources. And he can verify, again, too, everything we heard about how the people who staffed that first year of the occupation, the headquarters, the civilian headquarters, the people in the palace there who worked for Paul Bremer were political hacks. And, you know, Ken can confirm this. I mean, that was the resume that you were looking for was, these were political people. These were people who, and I remember when I got there. Oh, go ahead, Nick.
I was just going to say, I remember watching the documentary, was it No End in Sight? And I want to say it was Jay Garner but it may have been someone else on his staff who made the comment that they encountered the head of the traffic and basically the traffic division for Baghdad, the person who was going to control all of the reconstruction with regard to traffic control in a city of 5 million people. And it was like a 23-year-old Duke grad whose dad was a major Republican donor. And this was, yes, you know, 2 months after the war ended, after the shooting had stopped in, you know, March, April of 2003.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what, that kid still wasn't there when I got there in April of 04. May of 04. But he actually had done a pretty good job, because that was about the only thing that was being emphasized and talked about at that point in the spring was the traffic situation and when are the traffic lights coming. So that kid actually did do some work, but that just compared to like the rest of the, because when I get there in the spring, so what happens is I end up getting a job as a civilian with the Department of Defense and going to Iraq and getting put onto the very tail end of the Coalition Provisional Authority. So I saw the last 6 weeks of Paul Bremer's reign there. Like I say about Bremer, I never met him personally, but I was in staff meetings. And I saw the people that he was surrounded by and the people he had working for him. I mean, it wouldn't have mattered if Bremer was Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad rolled into one. With the people that he had around him, he was destined to fail. Because with the traffic light, that's one of the stories I like to tell, is that, so I'm there in a staff meeting at CPA at the end of May in Baghdad, and they are discussing the situation in Baghdad with regards to the traffic lights. And meanwhile, we were on the 23rd day in a row of car bombings in Baghdad. The head of the Iraqi governing council that we had put into place had just been assassinated by a car bomb. I mean, and things were falling apart across the country. And these people were saying, well, as soon as we get the traffic lights up, everything will come into, because they're just literally, you had this attitude of like, it can't be the occupation, it can't be anything more serious than the fact that they're just these grievances that people have, and the insurgency is not an insurgency. We weren't even allowed to say insurgency. I mean, all those things you heard about how you couldn't say the word insurgency for the first 2 years of the Iraq war, that was absolutely true. I mean, you were forbidden from saying that. I mean, it really was. It was, you were not. And so there were these blinders on the people who could actually think, but a lot of people there couldn't think. They were, like I said, when I got there in May, meeting all these people who are leaving CPA, and they were political hacks. They were, you know, most of the people would say to you, you say, what are you going to do when you get home? Well, I'm going to take a couple months off and then I'm going to go work at the convention, the Republican convention, the 04 convention. I mean, that was the, and but my position there was as a, I went over there originally to be part of the Ministry of Youth and Sport and to help them do soccer fields and help them do rebuild their youth centers and things like that, which was, I thought was going to be a fantastic experience. I was a combat engineer. And so my thoughts were maybe I could do this for a while and then come back and do some type of commercial construction or something, but having taken part in something that was going to help improve lives, you know, and still hopeful that things were going to turn around in Iraq or get better, or they were be, or maybe I was, because also too, in my position at the Pentagon, I had access. I mean, I had access to the intel reports that were coming in, right? I had friends who were in Iraq who were emailing me saying, hey, you work for Secretary of Navy. What the fuck is going on here, man? I mean, like, what are we doing? You know, I mean, like, does anyone know? You know, as well, too. Then also I read the newspapers and watched the television, you know, so like nothing, everything that was assaulting me, you know, from these things was just saying like Iraq is completely messed up. But then you had our civilian leadership saying, no, it's, you know. But I was hopeful, you know.
I think everybody was hopeful at some point. I mean, I think that I remember being a college student. I'm a bit younger than you. I graduated from college in 07. That's when I commissioned as an infantry officer. But I remember being a sophomore in college, you know, reading the news about the 2005 Iraqi parliamentary elections and being very, like, being like, crossing my fingers, like, come on, guys, I hope this works. I really, because you don't want, even if it is this imperial project, you don't want the people to suffer. And
that's right.
And then
Absolutely.
It's like, it looked like it actually had been pulled off and it was going to work. And then it's like, by the end of 06, we're like, yeah, maybe we were a little jump the gun on saying things were good.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we should have read into more of how the SUNY, you know, et cetera. But yeah, no. So I end up I get there and they moved the money and then they said, you're not going to do this youth and sport thing. We're going to reassign you. And I ended up going to Crete for a year. But right off the bat, too, I mean, I can tell you that the $20 million that was supposed to be the project I was a part of to rebuild these athletic facilities and youth centers and build soccer fields or whatever, that money was given directly to Skiri, to the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, whose militia is the Badr Corps. And $20 million bucks buys a lot of rifles and a lot of RPGs. And that $20 million in cash was just given directly to them by the administrators at the CPA, just handed right over to them. And yeah, I mean, the amount, and then there are kickbacks, of course. There are a lot of people, besides the political hacks at CPA, there are a lot of people who have been involved in reconstruction work in the Balkans, and they knew how everything worked. They knew the corruption was so thick, you know. But these were experienced, these are very experienced grifters, I guess, is what you'd describe it as. But wearing suits and ties with degrees from Harvard and Stanford, you know, who were able to manage it and make it look like it was actually something that was of benefit to the American national interest and to the interests of the Iraqis. But they were lining their own pockets very often. A lot of these people, just as much as the incompetence was there. But yeah, so I spent a year there into Crete doing reconstruction work, a lot of political work. I come back, I work at the State Department for a number of months as a consultant or a contractor on the Iraq desk there, because they couldn't hire enough people directly into the government, or they couldn't hire people at all into the government. So they just hired contractors, like guys like me who came back with Iraq experience to work on the Iraq desk. But then one day I'm sitting there and I got an email from a 4th Marine Division or you know, whoever it was from, saying we need volunteers. And so I open up the Excel spreadsheet, and the first thing on the list there is, you know, a thing for combat engineer company commander. And even though I knew the Iraq war this is the fall of 05. This is like November of 05, actually maybe December of 05. So even though I've been involved in this for a long time, I'm already sick of it. I feel the best thing we can do is just get out of there. The whole thing has been just an absolute horror show. It takes me about 8 seconds to decide whether or not to pursue this thing. And yeah, I pick up the phone. Marine Corps Reserves are so desperate for people. They didn't even really ask who I was. I mean, they're like, yeah, sure, you got the job, no problem. You know, it was like, hey, man, you want to, I mean, like, literally, that was it. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's strange because I can understand that perspective. By the end of 2012, I left the Special Forces course voluntarily, knowing that in my mind, the war was a train wreck and it wasn't going to get any better. And I wanted to get out of the military. And then at the same time, the first thing I did when I called my branch manager, I remember the name of the term. When I called my branch manager, I said, hey, I'm a 2+2+ in Pashto. Do you have any billets or anybody in Afghanistan? Now, the guy was an idiot, and he was like, yeah, whatever, you want to do secret squirrel shit, you should have stayed in the Q course. But like, obviously, if he had had the interest of the war in mind, he probably would have been like, oh, you speak Pashto, sure, I can find something for you. And it's like, I was fully ready to go back, even though I knew it was stupid, even though I knew it was dangerous. Yep. For some reason, it's like, when someone says, hey, we need help, the first thing that comes to your mind is, I'll go. And I don't know why
That's right.
I had the exact same thing.
It was like a punch in the gut. And again, and I mean, I'm in this position, I'm on the Iraq desk at State. It's like, it is completely screwed up. We are literally, I wouldn't say outright lying about the war, but on the public affairs side of it, but we are massaging the truth as much as possible and lying, I guess. Actually, lying is the right word to use. But also too, I mean, in the policy end of it, it is just, there is no coordination. No one knows what's going on. It is just, we might have all been planning a military operation in, at Dollywood, or in Seattle or someplace like that. As much as we are talking about Iraq, for as much as the people at the National Security Council, the people at CIA, the people at Pentagon, people at State had a conception of what was occurring there. And what the insurgency actually looked like, and what the population was suffering through, and what the—I mean—you would see Nate all the time. You would see these briefings where they would talk about reasons why people are joining the insurgency. And there would never be, or if there was, it would be at the very tail end. But oftentimes, it wouldn't even be listed. And this is going to senior policy people, senior. I mean, I was down, I was at the, worked a lot in the deputies committee level. So just one or two below, you know, the principals, below the Secretary of State and below the White Head, below Vice President and President. I mean, stuff I used to write used to go to them, to the Secretary and to the President and everything. And you would, there would be no mention that one of the most motivating factor, because we had the intelligence, we had the interrogations, we had polling, we had all kinds of things, that it was simply the occupation, or it was our abuse of people at Abu Ghraib, or our torture of people at Abu Ghraib, or our torture of people at Guantanamo Bay or in Afghanistan, or the fact that we've killed so many Iraqis already, or just the fact of our invasion, you know, I mean, just the occupation. So there were all that, any sense that the occupation or the insurgency might have legitimate grievances was completely scrubbed. That was not allowed to go forward. Even in late 2005, 2006, that was still anathema to the leadership in Washington, D.C. You could not present that. So you're talking about a war completely in false terms. But still, I mean, this thing comes up, and I go back because, again, like you say, you want to help. You want to do the role you've been given. You want to you need to take part. It's not a choice.
Well, so especially I mean, when you're an officer and you know that there's 19, 20, 21 year old young Marines or soldiers that are going to get deployed because they're active duty and they don't have a choice. It's like there's a thought process sometimes, like, well, it sucks and I know that it's bad, but like maybe in my heart I feel I might be able to help these kids do the wrong thing and potentially not get killed. And it's like and the thing about it is of course it's a naive thing because you can't be everywhere at once. It's just not possible. You'd burn out in 2 days. But you think, okay, maybe I'll make the difference, and that somehow puts you in a position mentally to be like, all right, I'm willing to accept this thing that I find intolerable.
That is absolutely right. You do, you know, so you go over there not thinking you're going to do anything good in the war, but that you're going to bring home more guys than maybe somebody else would, because you know that you're a good officer, you know you're competent, you know you're, you know, because there are a lot of officers that are not good, that are not competent. And I mean, you do. And so you did. So I ended up having a company. We went out and we got there September of 06. We were there through April and May of 07.
So basically the worst time in the war.
Yeah, we get to Anbar. You know, all I can say about that was thank God we weren't in Baghdad at least, but it was bad. I mean, like, you got, every time you went out, you got into a firefight or got blown up or something happened. I mean, like, things just, the amount of ticks, the amount of troops in contact was the measure was astronomical. I can't remember now off the top of my head, I'll give you a wrong number, but it was unbelievable how often in my regiment's AO, and we were in Western Anbar, so we had everything in Anbar province in Western Iraq, west of Ramadi. So we had this huge AO, and we had a Marine regiment out there reinforced with like one army battalion. And it was, I mean, it was for those months, we were, every time you left a FOB or a patrol base or a combat outpost or whatever we were calling them then, you got shot at, you got into a firefight, you got mostly hit by IEDs. And we did route clearance, and we did a lot of, my guys did a lot of breaching, cache sweeps, and we built a lot of bunkers. We bermed in the cities. We did a lot of engineering work, a lot of combat engineering work, you know, indirect support of the regiment.
When you say bermed in, I just feel like I want to make sure we clarify that for the listeners. You mean like building berms, like setting up things so that people have like defensive positions around cities, correct?
Well, not defensive positions. What we did was we did taking a cue from the Israelis. And this is where we got a lot of our strategy in 06 from. And this is why the notion that the surge was a military success is just fallacy. I mean, because we had a lot of short term games there militarily, but it was all the political components that made the Sunni awakening and the Sons of Iraq and brought down the violence in 07 and 08 to just incredibly low levels. I mean, we went when that happened, when the Sunni awakening happening and the Anbari tribes came onto our side. it went from having, say we'd have 100 ticks in a day in the regiment's AO, 100 actions a day in the regiment's AO, or 75 or however many it was a lot, you know, down to like 3 almost overnight. You know, I mean, it was, and what we found as the tier one guys came in to help us out, like the SEALs or Delta would come in, or our own recon guys would do it, or our own infantry would do it too sometimes. But as they rolled up the Al-Qaeda cells out there in Anbar, we'd find that these Al-Qaeda cells were 5 guys deep, 6 guys deep. That was it. That was the extent of the foreign fighters. The rest had all been local Sunni boys who were fighting us. I mean, it made the same sense. I went over there with 153 Marines and sailors. If those young men had been young Sunni men, you know, I always say like a third of them would have been dead, a third of them would have been in Abu Ghraib, and a third of them would have been fighting us. Same type of thing. They were fighting us because we were occupying them, because we had usurped them, because we had allied with the Shia, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, but burning the cities though was an Israeli tactic. We took over a population control, and we would build these wooden earthen berms around the city that were 12, 15 feet high, so no vehicles can get in. People could walk across it. But we closed off, well, we would close off all the roads except for maybe 1 or 2 going into the cities. Then we would bring in, more Sunni police and military. We wanted to give the towns back to, the cities back to the Sunnis to control. But it was basic population control. The people weren't allowed to leave for a couple of days. We had people die because they couldn't get to the hospital. We had, one of the things that haunts me is, you know, I made the decision not to allow a car to go through that had a pregnant woman I was later told the woman lost the baby, miscarried, you know what I mean? Like, so things like that, decisions I'm there making and other guys are making about this population control that cost people their lives, that caused people to suffer and die, that for me cost a woman her child. What the fuck? What the hell are we doing? You know?
Yeah.
That was Anbar. The politics of it, bringing the Sunnis back into the political process, the giving them a share of the spoils, so to speak, you know, making sure they were getting money as well as feeling that they were not going to be overrun by the Shia. That's what changed everything. But it really was incredibly freaky to go from where we were getting, where things were happening so much to just being deathly quiet. It was very freaky.
I was in a brigade that, when I deployed to Afghanistan, the 4th Brigade, 25th Infantry, they had formed up as a brigade in early 05 and then deployed in, I want to say, October of 06. And they stayed, I think the main element went home in November 07, but a couple, you know, some companies stayed on until December of 07. And getting the roll-up from them was similar to what you just described, that when they got there, it was like a catastrophic level of violence on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And by the end,
yeah,
they were basically doing meet and greets in the markets because nothing was happening.
Yeah.
Like the worst thing that might happen is that someone might pop a tire on the road on those, you know, those. Guys who had deployed in that, you know, I remember being in Afghanistan and having to really, it's tough being a first lieutenant, you know, having to kind of square these guys away who are combat vets, but they were approaching things in Afghanistan with that same threat level. And you realize from talking to them that they were used to an environment which within 20 minutes of walking out the gate, they were getting shot at. Whereas in Afghanistan, in Afghanistan, 9 times out of 10, it was quiet. And on 1 time out of 10, it was it was the worst fucking day of your life. So it's just, it was not the same kind of threat. And it's weird because these were people whose formative experiences as combat leaders were in this absolute apocalypse. And so when I meet people like yourself who are in that, I'm always fascinated because it's like, wow, I don't know how, I can't even conceive of it.
Yeah, it just was. We had a couple of companies. One of them was led by a couple of infantry companies in the regiment. One of them was led by a good friend of mine. His company was up in Haditha. And within the first couple of months, I mean, literally as we were getting into November, I remember being with him up there and he was looking at being combat ineffective from casualties. I mean, Marine Corps rifle company. I mean, like just because and Haditha looked like, Haditha looked like Stalingrad in parts of it. I mean, just the way the buildings had been hit and hit with 7.62 rounds and our rifle rounds and than, of course, from RPGs or from our heavy guns and everything, from our machine, from our 50 cals. And in other parts of that, and you just saw it where we were just losing guys every day. Massive catastrophic IED strikes. A 400-pound IED strike was nothing unusual. You know, I mean, and that's the kind of thing. It's like, how long does it take to, and that's what people don't get. How long does it take to put a 400-pound IED in the ground?
Yeah.
Right. And to move it, prepare it, and everything else. So we don't have the presence to see these guys doing this, you know, but then you're asking us to move across the ground like it is. And no one in the area, the local population, is seeing it happen because they're putting a 400-pound IED in the ground and they're not coming out to tell us, don't go there. Exactly. Why is that? And of course we say, well, it's because they're scared of the insurgency. And it's like, well, maybe because they also don't want us here. That could be a huge part of it too. You know, I mean, but, but that changed and it became, like I said, it was to go from that, where you were in that hell. And again, thankfully we weren't in Baghdad because the guys in Baghdad had it worse than we did. And same thing too, our guys down in Ramadi, had it really bad. Ramadi was awful, but we weren't going to get into like the 4 or 5 hour gunfight, you know, but you were going to get hit every time you went out or have something happen. At least something happened, or at least stop and at least find the IED before it went off, but still you're involved in that.
And that's hours and hours of just watching and waiting for EOD to come clear it or something like that. Yeah.
And you're waiting for something else to happen
You have this experience, you're there for, it's been like what, like 7-8 months, and then you come back, and then you wound up taking a position at the State Department.
Well, I did. I took a bunch of time off. That's when the PTSD and the moral injury, the guilt really started hitting me. I was involved in a helo accident over there, and 4 guys died in the helo accident, including a friend of mine. And I didn't think about it all until I got home.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that really kicked it off for me a couple months after getting back, was having to deal with that. I didn't save my friend. And what it was, we actually had a water landing, right? I mean, so these 4 guys drowned up on Haditha, up at the lake up there. And so these 4 guys drowned, including a friend of mine. And, and that was just a door to open it up to everything else. Once I admitted that my friend died and I didn't save him, which, you know, there was no way I could have saved him. But it's the guilt. You can't, right? So, but once that door was open, man, once that door was open, that's when everything changed and everything came flooding back, rushing back. All the things I've done, all the things taken part in, all the people all the Iraqis that I have worked with, particularly my first year, who have been left behind and were being killed and everything else, all that. And yeah, but I ended up taking a job 5-6 months later with, I came back and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm all done. And then some guy from the Joint IED Defeat Organization called and said, hey, just saw your resume and, with your background, you can help save a lot of lives, you know? So I was like,
the magic words right there.
Exactly. Right. So they go right back in. I go to work for JIDO for a year doing, counter suicide bomber work, for the most part. At that time too, end up getting a position with the State Department, as a political officer, because I have worked with states so much. I knew people, I had worked for before the man who is now the head of Afghan operations for the state. You know, I had a very good reputation, et cetera. So yeah, I get this direct appointment into the Foreign Service. Me and one other person, she had been Bill Richardson's foreign policy advisor. So Siri and I get appointed directly into the Foreign Service, and we both go to Afghanistan in the spring of 2009. And I'm there for about 5 months and, just can't do it. It's all the same stuff. I've had enough. I'm worn out. But all the same things occurring in Afghanistan that have been occurring in Iraq, particularly the political side of it. So whereas President Obama comes in, he talks about sending 2 brigades, which is what, about 10,000 soldiers. He ends up sending 70,000 soldiers, plus, 30 or 40,000 European troops, plus 100,000 contractors. You know, I mean, the desire is to escalate this war to win. to get the president a political victory, to get the Pentagon a victory, because you can't count Iraq as a victory. You know, I mean, God for, I mean, like that's a redo for the Pentagon under Gates. You know, he seizes his chance, and the generals do too. For a lot of the generals, like Petraeus, McChrystal, this is their chance to become the greatest military mind of their generation, whatever generation of war we're in now, what generation four, generation five, whatever these guys call it, you know, Petraeus want, you know, and that's the point when you start seeing people being like, Petraeus should get a fifth star. You know, I mean, like that's the, you start hearing these things. But also too, I mean, the war was just, it was, in Afghanistan, simply refused to speak with the insurgency, even though the insurgency wanted to speak with us, even though they have been trying to speak with us. We lie about it. We help Karzai steal the elections, basically. And it's all the kids are dying over lies, and Afghans are just suffering and dying over lies and over something that's immoral and something that's unwinnable. I mean, anyone of that brain on their heads can see every time we put American troops someplace or foreign troops someplace, along with the Afghan police and along with the Afghan army, the insurgency shows up. We would go to villages, man, and we would say, you know, where they hadn't seen us in like 3 or 4 years, because I was with a PRT, a provincial reconstruction team. And, you know, but we would go, and when was the last time you saw the Taliban? And they say, last time you guys were here, 3 years ago. I mean, like things like that. Like, and the way the insurgency worked, the way the insurgency was set up, the way, I mean, it just was so, again, to understand what was motivating the insurgency, and we knew what was motivating them. It wasn't a religious frenzy to establish a caliphate in the world. It was, you know, things going back for 40 years of war, plus resistance to occupation and a corrupt, predatory government.
It wouldn't be that difficult to understand that, you know, when people in America bridle under the notion that they have to pay taxes, and, you know, regardless of what they post on social media about supporting the police, like people still bridle at the notion of being pulled over and dealing with state authority. How do you think they would feel when a foreign government sends a military of people that don't look like them, that don't speak their language, that practice a different religion than them? Just their presence alone would be offensive, never mind the fact that like they also have a right to murder you and get away with it. And I mean, I was going to tell you, because you resigned. I mean, you told that and you wrote a letter. And so I'll tell you a story. That it's November of 2009 or end of October 2009. I'm sitting in the Indianapolis International Airport getting ready to fly to Atlanta and then onward to Kuwait and then back to Afghanistan. I'm finishing up my mid-tour leave. And I see a news story about a State Department representative who has resigned, and I read the resignation letter. It was your resignation letter. And there I was. I was a first lieutenant. I was in charge of a provincial coordination center in eastern Afghanistan. And I read, I was like, holy shit, somebody actually said what we're all thinking. Like, and I was like, wow. It articulated everything that I'm actually seeing on a daily basis. And I was so blown away by it. And now I've got you here on the mic. I'm wondering, could you talk about that letter and the decision that went into that?
Yeah, it took a while. It took a while for me to write the letter to quit. What happened was, you know, again, I saw all the same things, right? All the same stuff, and just couldn't do it any longer. There was a letter, an op-ed column written by Bob Herbert in the New York Times that summer about the death of Robert McNamara, who had been the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, and how before his death, McNamara admitted that he knew it was wrong. The war was wrong. The war was unwinnable in Vietnam, you know, but he still went along with the war and still sent, literally caused the deaths of millions of people, or helped with the deaths of millions of people. And that letter really, and Herbert's column, Bob Herbert's column, really struck me about that. It really struck me. And I sent it to my dad, and my dad wrote me back a really, really great email. And, you know, and that's what kind of gave me the strength to do what I felt like I had to do was right for my conscience. So I write this letter. I have two friends of mine help me. Both have been in Afghanistan. One had been the aide to the ambassador, and the other guy had been he's a Marine Corps intelligence officer who had spent a lot, you know. So I wanted to make sure everything I was saying was correct. And as this letter gets, as I resign and I quit, my boss in Kandahar, who is the, you know, one level down from the ambassador, he says, yeah, I can't disagree with any of this. you know? And then as I'm heading out, as I'm leaving, you know, I'm being contacted by other folks who are part of the embassy there. The guys who have the same jobs I have, political officers in various provinces, so they understand what it's like. So the people who are my peers in Kandahar and Helmand, in Uruzgan, in Kunar, in Nangarhar, who are not Kunar, Nuristan, she was up in, who understand this, who deal with this. They're telling me they completely agree with the letter. Yeah, you know, I mean, on and on. And then Eikenberry, Carl Eikenberry, who's the ambassador, he says to me, he wants me to stay. He agrees with my letter. He wants me to stay. He wants me to stay and be his personal advisor to General McChrystal, because he knows McChrystal doesn't get it. And McChrystal has the military mind of once you take one hill, you have to take the next. And no one is willing. I meet with McChrystal's people. I never met with McChrystal. He wasn't in the country or he wasn't around when I was leaving. And, but I meet with his people and it's just this circle of sycophants and yes men, whose attitude towards it, well, if the general didn't think it was the right thing to do, it wouldn't be the right thing to do. I mean, that really was the basis of why they were supporting this escalation of the war. And I mean, but yeah, over and over again. And of course, then Richard Holbrooke, who was the special representative for Afghan Pakistan, he says the same things to me. He says, man, I agree with 95% of your letter, you know, and I sent it to the president and I know Secretary Clinton read it, you know, all. And so that just gives me the courage to quit, because I know that, and what the guys who are, and a lot of the guys who are agreeing with me are saying, look, if I didn't have a wife and two kids ready to go to college, I quit too, but I've got the golden handcuffs on me, you know? So I go home, you know, I go home after writing this letter and, go back and I hang out for a while. I meet with Holbrooke. He offers me a job. I decide to take it, but then I quit the next day. I say, I can't do that. You know, what am I doing? You know? And, about a month or so later, I'm seeing a debate about the Afghan war. And no one is speaking about any of these issues. No one is speaking out. No one is saying, I mean, with the exception of some people, you know, there's some people, but I'm talking about people within the government, people within the, and I know from what Holbrooke has told me about how he has been basically cut at the knees by Secretary Clinton on this. He has no voice really on this, on these aspects of the war, because Clinton is so hawkish, because, you know, as we'll later see with Libya, this is a chance to prove smart power. This is a chance to prove the war credentials of the Democratic Party. And she's looking to run, you know, she knows she's looking to run in 7 years or so. So, like, she is so hawkish on the war that he is basically kept on the back bench, Holbrooke, and almost not allowed to speak, let alone bring up any of these issues. And this is the same thing Eikenberry told me as well. So, you know, it gets to a point where I'm sitting at a bar and I end up, one of those things, this guy is next to me who I get introduced to by my friend who's the bartender, is an editor at the Washington Post. And I end up talking to him and he tells me to send my letter to, or call the next day to the foreign affairs desk. And I figured they would call back and say, with some intern to ask me some questions if they're going to do anything. And they ended up, Karen DeYoung, who is one of their big reporters, one of their big international reporters, calls me back and I end up having this 6 or 7 hour long conversation with her. I have to go into her office and see her. And they take this is the first time I'm involved with the press since high school for track, you know? I mean, so I've got no idea what any of this is like, what I'm getting myself into. And then they publish this story, which is front page above the fold about me. I asked Karen afterwards, why did you do this? Why did you decide to write this about me and give me such presence? I mean, you could have put this on page 9. Why did you do this? And she said, well, it was a good story. People are going to be interested, et cetera, et cetera. But then she also said, because everyone I spoke to, no one told me you were wrong. You know, I mean, and like that type of thing, that's what's going on. This, you know, and then I've seen it since, and other people, you talk to people I was told that when General McChrystal's, the guy who was the head political advisor for NATO, the State Department guy who was the head for the NATO four-star, so not our supreme commander over there, but the guy, there's another four-star in the NATO ranks, and he was a German. And but our political advisor, I remember Jack telling me that when this went around, the escalation of the war, the plan, McChrystal's plan went around in for Afghanistan, went around in 2009 at NATO headquarters. Nobody signed off on it. Nobody agreed to it. But when it came time to initial your name next to it to push it to the next level up, everyone initialed next to it. And it was the same stuff, man. Same stuff as with Iraq. Same stuff as from the very early get on. I mean, like, yeah. Everyone agrees, get along to go along, you know.
Well, so, you know,
you're
it's
not
funny.
The one who's going to lose his legs, so, my, you know, you'll be okay.
You saying that just kind of, like, takes the fucking wind out of my sails because, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, but it's funny because, honestly, okay, so I started out as a platoon leader. I became the company, or headquarters company XO, leading up to the Afghan election, and because of a kind of a chance encounter where I'd been, you know, at night had been doing this on this course to learn how to speak Pashto. My battalion commander heard that and was like, hey, I really could use some help with, you know, with the election planning. So I was involved in the security planning and the coordination for all of the polling sites in all of the 12 of 19 districts in Paktika province that my battalion controlled. So I went to the meetings with the State Department, with UNAMA. I went to the meetings with the district field coordinators from all the different district sub-governors of these 12 districts, met with the governor a number of times, and saw the planning process. You know, met with the Independent Election Commission for Paktika, saw what happened, and saw the absolute logistical nightmare that was going to happen there. You know, like, they were going to drive all the ballots to the polling sites and then drive them all the way back. And I remember thinking to myself, like, so many people are going to fucking die. This is insane. Like, you can't let this happen. And so we came up with a plan where basically we were able to convince Presidential Airways, the Blackwater helicopter flight line.
Forgot about that.
To fly ballots. We did map recons of potential LZs, or used scouted LZs in every one of these districts that had been used before. And, you know, at that point, 8 years of war, that we got Apaches to go out there and do actual recons and fire these back to Presidential Airways. They flew in, picked up ballots at Sharana, flew them out there, then came and picked them back up. So I'd like to hope that that plan saved a lot of people's lives. I mean, it wasn't me, it was lots of other people that senior to me, but you know, we did the PowerPoint, we came up with a plan, we briefed it to hire. And then I was out there on the airfield loading up these helicopters and then recovering them. And then what I realized was in the news immediately after the election was that the reported fraud was astronomical and they said Paktika was one of the worst provinces. And I realized why. It's because they had the ballots. Because we had done it, because we had gotten it to them, because we had
That's
sent
exactly
it out.
Right.
We had done
That's
all this amazing. Work. We had burned, we had churned so much fuel, you know, the IEC had fucked up instructions to, or our company had made a mistake. I don't know, but like our company sent people out on a patrol to a polling site that wasn't supposed to be open because of security problems. They got blown up. Two guys died. A third later committed suicide. Like, it was horrifying. And you realize like all this happened and it didn't really amount to anything. And then when I came back after reading your letter, I came back to Afghanistan. I got back to it was right when Dr. Abdullah had decided to not contest the election. And so our governor threw this huge party, like, hooray, no second election. And I remember being like, wow, this is awesome. Like, we get to celebrate the fact that democracy is a complete failure in this country. And it was just, and so by then, by November of 2009, you know, I had, in November of 2009, I had a couple of different ticks take place at our compound, you know, a lot of situations where we had to, like, be the people to hand back dead bodies of insurgents to their families, which, I mean, as I've told friends before, like, you do the best you can, but imagine if the Taliban had a representative at Dover Airfield, like, or Dover Air Base, like, you know what that would be like. That was me in real life.
Exactly.
That was me in real life, handing over these body bags to people. Like, imagine if the level of, and then, you know, it's Thanksgiving, so I'm having to call my parents and be like, yeah, everything's fine. Meanwhile, you know, this shit's going on. And then in December, you know, had a really bad situation where you talk about moral injury, similar to me, you know, in the sense that I tried to get a kid medevaced and they wouldn't take him because the Americans didn't cause the injury and he wound up dying from a brain injury. And so, like, seeing that happen, and, you know, I joined the Army and put myself out there with the intention that, you know, I thought I could make a difference, and it didn't happen. But I think it was also, I bring this up because in December of 2009 was when President Obama announced the strategy. That was the whole plan. He had conducted this review. They had done this great big planning process. McChrystal had gone to every province and tried to go to every installation in Afghanistan. And then they announced that they were going to extend the troop deployment and stay until 2014. And I remember I stayed up really late at FOB Rushmore and went into the dining facility after hours to watch the news so I could hear what the decision was. And I was so disappointed because in my heart, I guess I sort of hoped that they would do the right thing, the thing that everybody on the ground knew, and say, all right, this is not going to work. And like in some diplomatic way, we're getting out. We're going to leave in the next couple of years. We needed to. And to see how it's happened. And now, 8 years later, you have people like Paul Ryan saying, well, if the Taliban know when we're leaving, they'll just wait us out. And I'm like, oh, yeah, because it's their country and they live there.
They live there.
Those wily Afghans, being citizens of that country that we invaded. But you see how nothing has changed. And it's just like, and I realize that the same things they're talking about now is what they were talking about in 2009. And you were already, mentally exhausted from having seen it over and over again. And I was getting my first taste of it. And I guess to me, it's like, you find yourself just flabbergasted that we can keep saying the same thing over and over again. And like you just said, people keep initialing next to the signature block.
Yep, exactly. And there was a real attitude within the embassy, within the political side of all this, of that, well, this is the Democrats. Of course, they're going to do it better than the Republicans. They're way smarter. There was that attitude as well, too. There really was this. You could feel it in the spring of 2009 as the new political people were coming in, as we were waiting for the new ambassador, everything else, but yeah, I mean, it's just the will. I think for a lot of military officers, though, what you do is you say, I can't do anything about that. All I can do is take care of my Marines or my soldiers, my sailors, my airmen. And that's what you focus on. And for me being there at that point as a State Department officer, I didn't have the things keeping me in the position in the war that other guys did in terms of having to feed a family and I was exhausted. I was the moral injury guilt from the Iraq wars had already started 2 years previous. The PTSD was there, whether I wanted to admit it or not. I was drinking real heavily, not in Afghanistan, but at home. I mean, I was drinking real heavily. Like I was suicidal at that point because of things, but in Afghanistan, I felt whole and complete doing that work. But, I didn't have the PTSD in Afghanistan until you start seeing that we were not going to be ending this war. We were going to escalate it. And I always look back to General Petraeus's comments when he takes over Central Command in 2008, and he talks about doing things in Afghanistan the way they've done things in Iraq. And so I'm thinking that means political settlement. I'm thinking that means actually addressing the grievances of the insurgency and separating the insurgency from the hardcore ideologues, from the foreign fighters, as we did in Iraq. And this is not what is happening. This is going to be a victory, and I've seen what's changed in myself. I mean, one of the things, one of the things I think about a lot now is that when I was in Anbar in 06, 07, your comment before, Nate, made me remember it. But you guys brought the bodies back to the families of the people you're killing. We actually got into the place. It was so vicious there in Anbar, and I'm sure it's happened maybe in other places. It was so vicious that the regimental level, and I was both a company commander and a regimental staff officer, but at the regimental commander, the regimental commander had the regimental staff decide this. We decided to not police the bodies off the streets, that anyone we killed, we left on the streets, and we were not going to allow their families to pick them up, and the dogs would eat them.
Oh, my God.
And never thought that would be, and I agreed with that. I voted for it. I remember sitting there around that conference table at regiment headquarters and voting on it, type of deal. Like that's it. And I was allowed, in the sense of like, I got Marines out there. My Marines are with the grunts. My Marines are all over the place. I've had a bunch of kids wounded already, grace of God, they haven't been killed. And I was more than happy to have the dogs eat these people on their streets rather than their mothers and their sisters recovering them. That's the person I have become. That's the very person I have become because of war. And now we see 8 years later in Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East, right? What's happening in Yemen, what's happening in Iraq now with the campaigns against the Sunnis in the Euphrates and up the Tigris River valleys, you know, what that campaign looked like, just just the destruction of cities. And that's what you get. You get a moral devolvement when you're just with this violence and this killing and this war all the time that you don't even recognize yourself. And I don't think it's change. I say war doesn't change you. I believe that war just allows you to see who you really can become. All this stuff is in us. All this stuff is inherent in who we are as human beings. This ability to get so fully swept up in the revenge cycle of violence to justify anything. And that's who we are. Yeah.
I noticed it for myself. I mean, it was different. My deployment was different than I suppose, obviously, it could have been. But what I noticed for myself was that I stopped caring. I was very empathetic, and I was very bothered by even the random acts of aggression that had to take place, the way that we treated people at checkpoints, the way that we treated people at searching their vehicles, or, you know, people coming to the gates, the way we treated people on patrol. And then by the end, when I had friends die, I was like, it sounds horrible, but I remember having to be in a meeting with a guy who had been, I mean, he was trying to recover his truck that had been burned after getting blown up on a convoy, and the Afghan government had paid somebody to recover it and told them you can keep it, and he wanted it back. And the NDS had sent people out in American style ACU uniforms and beat the shit out of this guy. And he was trying to, you know, get some redress. And I was sitting in the meeting with him, and I remember thinking, like, I don't fucking give a shit about your problems. Like, I just, you know, and it was a very stark moment. And I regret that, of course. I mean, we tried to get him redressed. We got him at least a chance to talk to the people who might be able to help. I don't know what happened later. But that was a very, for me, as a person who doesn't like to see these sorts of things happen, who, you know, in a naive way, puts a high emphasis on fairness, it just made me stop caring about fairness completely. So I agree entirely with what you just said.
Yep, absolutely. You do. You take this, and you get to a point, though, where maybe things, like I said, I had that Bob Herbert column and the email back from my dad about it, about you have a choice. You have a choice who you want to be and what you want to do. And I was able to make that decision and make that choice. And but I think it's also, too, it's one of the reasons why we see such high suicide rates, you know, among combat vets. You know, and why I think it's a real reason why there's such a difference in suicide rates between active duty and veterans. I mean, among active duty, the suicide rate is just a little bit higher than among the civilian population, among their peers. But once you start to get to veterans, once they become veterans, once they leave that bubble, you know, once they leave that community, and I think we allow ourselves to think this way. We allow ourselves to have these honest thoughts. We allow ourselves to have this honest introspection, or you hear opposing views. The dissonance that occurs, that you see that this was the person I was, and this was never a person I expected I would be. Because so many of us do join the Marines or the Army or the Navy or Air Force or whatever because we're looking to do good in whatever way. I mean, I joined because I was bored, but there's also part of me that wanted to help, that wanted to serve, protect, do something bigger with myself. And then you do this, and it just strips out the foundations of who you are. And a lot of young men, and also a lot of young women too, are, you know, not able to handle it and put a pistol in their mouth.
Something that I wanted to talk about too, since we have a little bit more time, if you're okay with hanging on a little bit on the line.
Oh, absolutely.
I wanted to talk about what you do now, about the anti-war work and anti-militarism work, because I feel like you've taken the next step in a way that I think a lot of us struggle to. I mean, I do my show and I espouse my opinions, and I get mad online about certain things, and try to gain. And I've gained a little bit of an audience doing so. I've written about PTSD. I've also seen a lot of pushback. I mean, I wrote about PTSD. I wrote about veterans being used as political props, and then I wrote about the sort of mental process that makes somebody think they still need an AR-15 to defend themselves in America. And what I realized was that it was like I had insulted the religious totem of a significant number of veterans in America. And I realized that anger, that inchoate anger, is still there. And I don't want to play armchair psychologist, but I realized that a lot of people are very, very, very angry. And you and I have talked about this too, that, like, for example, you know, I was the person that wrote the story that sort of broke the Bergdahl deserted thing. I mean, I regret some of the way that got spun, and I found myself very, very disappointed with the cynicism of how the sort of news cycle works, but Bergdahl did obviously walk off an outpost.
Yep.
And it was my unit. And I realized later on that so many people were so enraged with Bergdahl and wanted to project all of the failures of the war onto Bergdahl because it was the only appropriate target in their mind. What they were mad about was that the war had failed, that they had been lied to. But instead of being mad at the people who made the decisions, they're mad at this kind of silly, depressed private who had delusions of grandeur. And,
yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
And I realized that was sort of this breakthrough moment. I realized, like, deep down somewhere, people know that they've been lied to and that this war is wrong and it shouldn't continue. And getting to the point where they can actually admit that to themselves and to people in public and not fear that they're going to be labeled a coward or a traitor or a quitter. Because quitter is a word I hear quite often. And and I wondered for you, you've definitely taken the next step. And so I was hoping you could talk about that.
Yeah, you know, and the Bergdahl thing is a great example. You know, I mean, we go back to, and what you're saying, I mean, this is basic stuff, right? I mean, this goes back to Francis Bacon and his whole idol of the tribe, you know, the idols of the tribe. You know, I mean, you insult the idols of the tribe and the tribe has no other choice but to destroy you. And that's what people carry these things in themselves, these truths that if they let go of, who are they then? They have no purpose. They have no meaning. And it's the very foundations of the moral injury, the guilt, again, that and we've known that about guilt, just to make sure people are clear on this, we've known about guilt as a driving influence in suicides for combat veterans for decades now. I mean, go back, there was a study done in 1990 by the Veterans Administration that very clearly states the best predictor of suicide in Vietnam veterans is combat-related guilt. And since then, almost every other study has confirmed this. Out in Utah, the National Center for Veterans Studies did a meta-analysis 2 years ago in 2015, 23 studies on the relationship between suicide and combat. They threw one study out, the other two, because it just wasn't done correctly or whatever. But the other 22 studies all show that there is a significant and overwhelming relationship between killing in combat, whether you're directly involved or indirectly involved, doesn't mean you have to be alone, and suicide. There is an overwhelming relationship. There's no denying it. And that's why we see, our youngest Iraq and Afghan vets right now have suicide rates 5.5 to 6 times higher than their peers, than other young men their age. You know, I mean, they've tracked infantry battalions where the suicide rate is 14 times higher than civilian peers. You know, I mean, we know this stuff, right? And this is what, but for me, I did, so I had this celebrity and everything, this Afghan war celebrity type of thing as the guy who quit and all the greatness that comes with that or, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, like, it took me a while, though, Nate, to really embrace where I was morally. Because I still hedged. There was still part of me that wanted to stay in the establishment. There was still part of me that wanted to, that thought I had a chance to come back in, go back into the government. I mean, I knew of men like Tony Lake, who had been with Bill Clinton, you know, but and Lake had resigned from the State Department over the Vietnam War. So I knew that people could leave and then come back in later on. I kind of had that. So I was hedging on a lot of what I was saying. So the work I was doing at the think tank I was a part of, I was always conscious of making sure I didn't do anything that was going to keep me from ever getting back in the establishment. And it took me a couple of years to get past that.
Yeah, you don't want to cross the line too much because then
that's right.
the career opportunities are going to get cut. I mean, because there is a certain point at which if you start to decry not poor policy and not poor tactical decision making, but rather the entire imperial apparatus.
That's
when
right.
When you say those words, you've basically you've sort of kicked over the set pieces, and there's no coming back from that.
That's right, and you have to understand. I mean, everything in George Orwell wrote about this in 1945. He says in an essay, Notes on Nationalism, Orwell says, you know, what's most striking, he says something along, I'm going to paraphrase here, but he says, what's really striking to me is the fact that all through these wars, the same people have spoken about the wars as experts, pundits, as we would call them now, and they've gotten everything wrong, yet they keep being the ones who are on the radio and in the newspapers And he says this is because they represent interests, entrenched interests that have money behind them. And that's why you keep hearing from the same people over and over again about these wars, even though they get everything wrong. And that's what we see today. And so you want to make sure that you are aligned with some interest. Otherwise, you won't have a place in Washington, D.C. Or in the media. But eventually, though, through a lot of several reasons, some of it was my own personal health, because the last few years I now suffer from I have a neurocognitive disorder. It's most likely from traumatic brain injury, probably from the large amount of explosives I've been around, both in training and then in combat. But yeah, the last couple of years, I've really had this brain injury develop, that has really limited what I could do. I had to take almost a year and a half off from a lot of stuff I was doing. Couldn't use my computer for a long time, almost the better part of a year. Just couldn't handle using a computer. And, but that helped me realize, like, why am I hedging? Why am I not? So now I work a lot with an organization now called Veterans for Peace. The think tank I'm still associated with is a think tank that's dedicated towards, policies of militarism. But when Obama is in office, you don't go that far with that, And now Trump's in office. Give you an example. In our think tank, we have an organization called Women Without War. Guy who runs it, Steve Miles, terrific guy, does great work. He's always in Congress. He is doing absolute work. All throughout Obama's time, Steve had one person working with him. 6 months into Trump administration, he's got like seven people working for him now. Because, the interests are now giving money back again, because it's good to be anti-war again, because that means you're anti-Trump.
Yeah.
But if you're not sticking with principles, if you're not sticking with who you really are and what you really believe, you are doing yourself a disservice. You're just lying to yourself. And then you realize one day that you've never gotten anywhere and you're not actually achieving what you have and what you can offer by that continual lie, by not being who you are and what you really believe. You're always hedging. And I came across this in something that Stephen Pressfield wrote. Stephen Pressfield, a big author, he wrote Gates of Fire. Lots of guys are familiar with him for that. But Pressfield wrote, he said that's a definition of a hack. A hack is somebody who writes something not from what's inside his heart and his mind, but for the interests of somebody else. And that's really affected me. So I didn't want to be a hack. So yeah, now I do this anti-war work and this peace work, and both in the U.S. and abroad, because I don't want to be a hack, basically.
I remember last year, I believe it was, you found yourself at protests in Okinawa, and mm-hmm. you had previously served as a Marine in Okinawa. So I'm wondering, yeah. what did that feel like going back there and confronting the machine in a way?
That was really, that was maybe the hardest thing for me to challenge was Okinawa, because I had, as a junior officer there, as a lieutenant there in Okinawa, I had had such a good experience. I had had an Okinawan girlfriend. I had had the Marine Corps brochure experience. This is before the wars, basically. This is what the Marine Corps is supposed to be about. You're training Marines, you're traveling, and the ideas of that we are an occupying force and that the majority of Okinawans didn't want us there, let alone the history of Okinawa and what Okinawa was like as a U.S. military colony, was just something I didn't know and didn't care to know about. Now I do. And it really was a different experience. It was a very sad experience because Okinawa is such a beautiful place. The Okinawan people are so gracious. And 80% of Okinawans want the bases closed or moved or dramatically downsized. 80%, not some, but 80% type of deal. And you learn the history of Okinawa, and you learn that when we controlled Okinawa as a military colony for the first decade at least, and even longer, the Okinawans had as little political and economic control over their lives as people in East Berlin or East Germany did. So the very things, they weren't allowed to leave the island without the approval of U.S. military authorities. They were not allowed to have political assemblies. They didn't control their economy. It was controlled by the U.S. military. a quarter of the island's residents died in the Battle of Okinawa. But then in 1951 or 52, we forcibly moved a quarter of the remaining residents from their homes to make room for our bases. I mean, all these things are not known to us. You know, I was there for 3 years. I never heard about this forced movement of a quarter of the island's residents. And we did it. We had done it in the early 50s to make room for our bases, to expand Kadena Air Base. You know, I mean, things like that. We kicked people out of their homes. And then the worst aspect, the thing that underlies it all, that ties it all together, that brings all occupations, all these colonial and imperial adventures. And last year, I was fortunate to visit Okinawa, and then go and take part in the resistance at Standing Rock, and then also go to Palestine as well. And then also, too, I was just actually in Charlottesville. So it kind of ties this all together very well for me in my head and myself of this the commonness that it goes across occupation is just the brutality of it and the humiliation of it and the fear that comes with it. In Okinawa, for decades, American service members raped Okinawan men and women, boys and girls, with near immunity. If you were a service member in the 50s and 60s and 70s up into the 80s, you could rape an Okinawan, and most likely the worst thing that's going to happen to you is you would get sent home early from your tour. You might get fined. You know, you see these numbers about how, like, I just saw something the other day that over the course of however many decades, a few hundred Okinawans were raped by. That's such a load of garbage, you know, that, and these numbers that got put out by the U.S. military about the crimes that the American service members committed in Okinawa, it's such a load of garbage because the Okinawans will tell you themselves they couldn't tell anyone. There was no one to tell about the crimes. The Americans never did anything about it. I mean, so we have these statistics that supposedly show that we didn't do this to the Okinawans, but those are just a great grand lie. But it was, so you had Okinawans for decades living with their families who were in constant fear that their children or their wife would be raped by an American service member because it was that prevalent. There was a rape culture that existed there.
I mean, I'm reminded of the extent to which people, I mean, the army only barely cracked down on things like that in West Germany, you know, in the 80s. I mean, yeah. It wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s, you started to see people getting prosecuted for crimes against German citizens. And that's a country that had far more independence in the grand scheme of things,
yeah,
versus Okinawa.
And that's a country where racism wasn't a factor.
Yeah, right? Yeah, agreed, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because with you rape an Okinawan, that's just some brown girl, you know? But you rape a German, that's a white girl. You know what I mean? There's that, yeah. That's a huge factor. So going to Okinawa was, and taking part and being accepted by the Okinawans in the same way we were accepted by the Native Americans at Standing Rock, in the same way accepted by the Palestinians, in the same way just recently as accepted by all these black students in Charlottesville. Like, here I am as this white male, like the very, I was in the military. I was the very embodiment. I did occupation in Iraq. In Afghanistan, I worked on occupation policy. I was a colonial administrator for all intents and purposes in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I am the very embodiment of white imperialist occupation. And here are these people in all these locations, whether they be Okinawan, you know, Asian, whether they be Palestinian, Middle Eastern, Muslim, whether they be Native American or whether they be African American, and they accept me as one of their own. No questions asked. And it shows you the kind of people they are as opposed to the kind of people we are, you know? And it really has really struck me and stayed with me this past year.
Well, I mean, so I guess my last question would be, I as a result of this podcast and as a result of work that I've done elsewhere with other organizations, I find myself coming into contact with young people who are in the military who want to get out and want to find a way to work against the same things that we're describing here. The kind of the culture of the imperialism, impunity, the notion that we have the right to determine people's futures for them around the world. And I was wondering, say you had a chance to speak to one of those people, what would you tell them?
Oh, I refer people to Charlie Chaplin's speech from The Great Dictator at the end. Which is just a wonderful speech. If you haven't seen that, get on YouTube and look that up. But at the end of The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin, this is a a satire and assault on Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany that Chaplin did. He says, don't give your life. He's talking to the soldiers. He says, don't give your lives to brutes. And that's the line I use, or I paraphrase, what are you doing? You have a choice. Do not give your lives to brutes. Do not make the same mistakes I've made. And everything you have been, but still, that doesn't, you know, you can say that to your bull in the face, but they have to still do it. They have to still see it for themselves, the experience. And so what I speak to them when they're in, and this is part of the work we do with Veterans for Peace, when we were in Palestine, a lot of our work was speaking to the Israeli military and the Israeli police and speaking to them and saying, hey, brother, you know, I was a Marine. I was in Iraq. I did the very same things you're doing here to the Palestinian people. Look, you have a choice. And not to humiliate them, not to harass them, not to make them feel like they are wrong or they're a murderer or anything, but to support whatever is inside of them, support that conscience, support that heart of theirs, support them to make the right decision or help them make the right decision, and realize who they are. You're not going to get anyone to embrace dissent or embrace their conscience by attacking them and mauling them. You get that by supporting them and showing them yourself and being human to them. And that's what we've done a lot of, and that's what we try and do with Veterans for Peace, is communicate that and educate that and let them know that there are people who think this way, who have been in the same positions, who've made the same mistakes, who've already done it. Like, you know, I mean, we've done it, I did it in Iraq and Afghanistan, took part in the killing. We have Vietnam veterans and Korean veterans and World War II veterans in Veterans for Peace who all took part in the killing, who killed, you know? I mean, and that's where we come from. It's like, look, we have done this, and we are telling you that it cannot be done well. And no matter how strong of a person you are, no matter how moral you think you can be, in the immoral world of war and violence and occupation, you will be defeated. Your morality cannot hold up against the immorality of the war and the occupation, the violence, the imperial, it cannot. And that's what we try and help people moving along and remind them they have a choice. You have a choice. You have a choice. What are you going to do? And that choice may mean going to jail. If, say, you're in Israel, you know, you desert, you know, or you're, you know, but you have the choice. And that's what we try and get across to them. Yeah. I also tell them, if they're a junior officer, I always tell them to read David Hackworth's book about face.
Well, I have a junior officer that I've been speaking to who's in the same sort of moral dilemma, so I will recommend that to him. Matt, thank you so much for your time. Seriously, this is what I'm thinking we're going to do here is actually break this into two segments so we can have the full interview. And we'll publish it over the course of 2 weeks. But this has been phenomenal. And what I'd also like is we'll open up the lines to people to send comments, you know, by email and such. And I may ask if you have time to respond to some of the questions, because I imagine that you're going to get a bunch. And when we're done, what I'll do is see if there's any information you want me to put out as far as like where to reach out for some of these organizations in question. That would be really helpful too.